We invite you to turn to 1 Timothy chapter 5 this morning, 1 Timothy chapter 5. As we continue to work our way through a section in which Paul is addressing Timothy about spiritual leadership at the church at Ephesus and how the congregation, Timothy and the congregation, need to relate to them. The first thing that Paul did was sort of start on the positive note, honor those who serve well. That is, if they rule well and work hard at preaching, teaching, they're worthy of a double or twofold honor. And so he starts positively, but then he moves to deal with the negative side, to confront those who don't rule well. If they engage in sin, how do you handle the discipline of pastors or elders? You have to do so justly, on a just standard, verse 19, on the basis of two or three witnesses. It needs to be done publicly or openly, verse 20, those who continue in sin rebuke in the presence of all, so the rest also will be fearful of sinning, and then it needs to be done impartially. Verse 21, I solemnly charge you in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus and of his chosen angels to maintain these principles without bias or prejudice or prejudgment, doing nothing in a spirit of partiality. So those that are doing their job well, double honor. Those who are actually not serving according to the scriptures, they're engaged in some form of sin, falling short of God's standard. You need to deal with it openly or transparently and without any kind of partiality. So if that's the case, then in all probability, there's going to be some vacancies. Right? If there are actually folks who've sinned, and we know that at Ephesus there's a conflict and a problem there, and so if they do what Paul is telling them to do, then there may be a shortage of leaders, and they need to take steps to actually appoint new leaders. And that's what verses 22 through 25 address. So let's read that text of Scripture, which will be the focus of our study this morning. 5:22. Do not lay hands upon anyone too hastily and thereby share responsibility for the sins of others. Keep yourself free from sin. No longer drink water exclusively, but use a little wine for the sake of your stomach and your frequent ailments. The sins of some men are quite evident, going before them to judgment. For others, their sins follow after. Likewise also, deeds that are good are quite evident, and those which are otherwise cannot be concealed. In this text, really there's just one main command or responsibility at the beginning of verse 22. The governing command of it is, do not lay hands upon anyone too hastily. So it's stated in negative form as a restriction with regard to the task that Paul is talking to Timothy about, and that's the issue of leadership appointment or affirmation. And that's really what the phrase lay hands on means. Don't get in a fight with anybody, right? It's talking about actually the formal process that when someone is being commissioned or appointed to a task or ordained to a task, that there would be a symbolic marking out of that with the laying on of hands, that they would be identified in that way. We see that in Acts chapter 6 and verse 3, actually, with the deacons. And Acts chapter 7, it refers to it. Titus chapter 1 talks about it. We saw it already in chapter 4, verse 14, where it talks about the laying on of hands of the elders with regard to Timothy, the laying on of hands. So it is what we sometimes formally call the issue of ordination. If you've been around over the last year and a half, I've tried to steer a little bit clear of that word, only because it has sort of a traditional crust around it, which I don't think is the best way to think about it. Because we think ordain somebody makes them a part of the clergy versus being a non-clergy member or a layman. And so it creates sort of a semi-caste system. But the fact is that you had deacons, pastors, and missionaries all subject to this issue of having laid hands on them. because it was merely appointing them for a task or a work, setting them apart, identifying them in that regard. And so it is, I think, something that's more task-oriented than it is status-oriented, if I could put it that way. Right? You've been given a task, and you're supposed to carry out that task. You don't now have a little title, reverend, that puts you in a category so that you're now set apart in some kind of a clerical role in that regard. And I think that that's important. Even though that title is used and there's all kinds of stuff connected to it, the point is you've been set aside for this work, and it generally involved other leaders, recognized leaders as a part of that pattern. For instance, like chapter 4, verse 14, the laying on the hands of the elders, that those who were already elders were involved in the laying on of hands with regard to Timothy. And in this case, Timothy is included in the process of what's happening at the church at Ephesus. And so there was something of, I think, a practical, if I could put it this way, sort of outworking of 2 Timothy 2:2. Remember, Paul says to Timothy, the things you've received from me among many witnesses, entrust to faithful men who'll be able to teach others also. So there is actually a leadership multiplication responsibility, or if I could put it this way, a leadership reproduction responsibility, right? One generation entrusts truth to the next generation, which is to entrust it to the third, which will reach the fourth. And so it makes sense that those who are in that chain would be a part of this leadership recognition process as well. And it would be identified as something of a symbolic act to formally consecrate somebody to their task or to their appointment. So in our church, we do that. We've done that with when we've sent out church planters or missionaries. When we worked earlier this year, as we worked through the process of installing other pastors in our church, we engaged in this process as well. And so it's something that is has biblical roots, and just make sure we need to define it and understand it biblically as well. But here's the restriction they put. Look at verse 22. Do not do this, lay hands upon anyone too hastily. So there's the restriction that they wouldn't do it too quickly, and that's really the idea of it. And so he's establishing something here of a testing period or a timetable, which, again, shouldn't surprise us. Go back to chapter 3 and verse 6 for a moment, right? When he's listing the qualifications for an overseer, which is the same thing as an elder or a pastor, in verse 6, he says that this person should not be a new convert so that he will not become conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. So there's the first indication in the book that this shouldn't be a hasty process, right? You don't go from just trusting Christ to being set apart as a shepherd in the assembly. So it shouldn't be a new convert, verse 6. Look at verse 12 as well. I'm sorry. Verse 12. Deacons must be, no, that's not it. I got to back up so I can actually read. Verse 10, there it is, okay. These men must also first be tested. And it's referring to the deacons, but if you remember when we went through this, I zeroed in on that word also, right? These men must also first be tested. So that, I think, implies that this would be true of the overseers as well. He just talked about the qualification of the overseers, and then he moves to the deacons, and he says, now these men must also first be tested, implying that the others were actually put to the test and examined, and it wasn't a quick process that led them to that. I already quoted to you 2 Timothy 2:2, and what's the key word in that verse that would indicate that you don't want to do it too hastily. Right? The same entrust to faithful men. Right? You can't prove faithfulness in a microwave oven. Faithfulness happens over time. It's demonstrated obedience and following of Christ. So here you have three texts that would inform our text, right? When you lay hands on someone or mark them off or appoint them for leadership ministry in the church as an elder, they shouldn't be a new convert. They should have been tested. They should be faithful. All three of those would actually support the idea of not laying hands on too hastily, right? You need to make certain that they have demonstrated some level of spiritual growth and maturity, that they have some level of proven faithfulness. Not hope so, not, they look like they'll do a good job, but that you actually have seen it. And when I say maturity, what I would say, and I would say this as an implication of Ephesians 4, in Ephesians chapter 4, Paul's talking about the church coming to maturity, and I have used three words to describe that maturity. There's unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, that they come to the full measure of the stature of Christ, that they are no longer children tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine, right? So if that's what the body is supposed to be, I think it stands to reason by implication that those who are leading the body should embody that, right? So that they have a clarity about their doctrine, unity of faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, right? They're not a brush pile of theological truth, but they actually are centered in that theology, that they are conforming to the character of Christ, right? The full measure, the stature, the fullness of Christ, and that they are stable. They're not prone to doctrinal winds that blow through, right? So unity and conformity to the character of Christ and stability in the truth and doctrine. And those take time, right? I've seen it on multiple occasions, but I mean, sometimes you watch people who are leaders who chase after every hot theological or topical issue imaginable. Like they're over here, And they're just like pounding that drum and chasing after that, and then that's not the hot topic anymore, and all of a sudden there's some other thing, and they're off after that, and they're off after this. And the reality is that sometimes they embrace polar opposite positions in a pretty rapid fire time. That would be the indication of somebody not qualified to be a leader. Because actually, if you're going to lead God's people toward Christ-likeness, conformity to the truth, that presupposes you sort of know where that is. Right? I mean, you know, if we all go out to church, we say, hey, let's go out to dinner. Yeah, that's a great idea. Where are we going? Well, I'm not quite sure. Just, you know, hop in the car. We'll go. Well, it might work if you got one car. Wouldn't work real well. Right, but you could just pick any restaurant. But if you got people trying to follow you and the lead car has no idea where you're going, you ever been behind somebody like that? Right, you start hanging back farther and farther because you're not sure when they're going to make some kind of a turn. I mean, the same thing's true in spiritual leadership. Right, if those who are responsible to lead have not settled in their hearts, their commitment to the truth and godliness, and have demonstrated proven faithfulness, then they're not going to be the kind of leader that the church needs and is obedient to the scriptures. But why is it sometimes that we ignore that? Why do we sometimes prematurely put people in positions? Well, because we live in a culture that prizes personality. Right, a dynamic person, we immediately say they're a leader, right? And there's some truth in it, right? I mean, the reality of it is there are people who walk in a room, pretty soon they're going to be leading. But that doesn't mean that they ought to be. It doesn't mean that that's good, and the church is guarded against that by not having that kind of personality-driven or ability-driven kind of basis for it, right? Because it's not just a matter of personality and ability when it comes to spiritual leadership for the church. The scriptures talk about it being issues of proven character and conduct of life, as well as creed and some level of competence in the things that they're called to do. And so it takes time for those things to be evidenced. There are personal and familial and ministerial aspects to it that can't be gauged in a moment's time. And it has to do with their need to be taught and trained and tested. And so there can't be this kind of rush to leadership. And I think it's important for us to recognize that. And I'll be open and honest about it. I think that a part of... So what I would say, I'll just personalize it, right? So I would think the first time I had hands laid on me to set me aside for ministry was when I was on staff at another church. And I think, honestly, it was too early given what the scriptures say. Right? I wasn't even done with seminary. I was basically hired to a staff and given a pastoral position. And this can be hard to say without sounding like arrogant, but obviously big personality, ability to stand up in front of a crowd and speak. So hey, that guy's going to be a, you know, go. And that's not what Paul's talking about, right? Actually, that's probably not the way to go. And so we've always been slower, but even here, when I came back, I think I was too quick to give out a title in order to try and elevate the people serving in positions, right? And again, it sets historic context is it used to be one pastor and everyone else was just whatever. They were an assistant to the pastor, they were a director. And I didn't feel like it actually was giving the leadership to those positions that it needed. So here was my, what I would say, youthful answer. Put a title on it. All right, so just start calling them Pastor So-and-so. And that way people have, because we call all our teachers Mr. This and Miss That. And we just call guys on the church staff by their first name. And I thought, well, let's put a title on it, elevate it. Right, but that wasn't prudent. So we began changing away from that, and started saying, okay, no, we're gonna wait until you reach a certain place of training and testing before we'd move to that direction. And then I think this year, good move, is actually brought the congregation into the equation and said, actually, if we're going to give that title to somebody, the congregation needs to be affirming that, and us identifying them in that way, okay? And that would be, and I'm just trying to walk you through, hopefully, the evidence of the work of the Word of God on even my thinking and our leading and the church, that we should be always, I mean, there's a Latin phrase, I don't hardly ever quote Latin, right? But semper reformandum, always, always reforming. Right? We should never think that we have arrived, but that we should always be letting the scriptures shape us so that we're thinking more biblically about things. Okay, and seeking to develop it. And a part of this leadership component, I think, is very important in that regard. So he says, don't do it too hastily. I think it is important here to see he doesn't set an age limit. Okay, because here's the tension for us. And actually, especially the older we get, right, as we start to look at young people and think, well, they haven't got enough experience yet. And that's not really what he's saying. He's not talking about let them get older. He's saying don't rush to judgment. All right? Timothy's a young man here. who's actually leading the process. So it's not like wait until they're old. He's saying when they've just come to Christ, you can't put them into spiritual leadership, right? You can't do this to a new convert. If they haven't been tested, then you can't do this, right? If they haven't proven faithful, you can't do this. So how long does it take for that to happen? He doesn't give us a timeline. He doesn't say so 9 to 12 months or, you know, 3 years to 5 years. And I think we're going to come back to it in a moment. I think it would be some time happening, but without us, like what we want to do is say, okay, so give us a policy here, Paul, right? Tell us the standard answer to the question so we never have to think or make judgments. And that's not what he's doing, but he's giving us principles that are saying, listen, you need to move in such a way that what you're looking for is growth and maturity and stability. That's what you're looking for. You're not looking for the most obvious things that people look for, especially in our culture, in terms of making somebody a leader. All right, the basic point really he's saying is don't do it too soon. Which means, I think, that you need to make sure that you're sure. Right? Make sure that you're sure. And if you're going to err, however you like to pronounce that one, do it on the side of caution. Do it on the side of caution. Right? So if you have a restriction that says, do not lay hands on anyone too hastily, then the problem is doing it too hastily. And so if you're going to err, you're going to err on the side of caution and say, okay, let's make sure we're sure. That's what the text, I think, would be driving at. So why is that? Why is that? Well, the first reason comes in the second part of verse 22. It says, and thereby share responsibility for the sins of others. Keep yourself free from sin. So here's a concept that I think is important for us to grasp about this, right? If you do it too hastily, that's the point, right? Don't do it too hastily. Because if you do it too hastily, you participate in the sins of other men, right? You would share responsibility. And actually, the word that Paul uses here is the word from the word family of fellowship or sharing or partnership, right? So Paul says to the Philippians, I thank God for your fellowship or participation or partnership in the gospel from the first day till now. And that's what he's saying is Timothy, if you do this too quickly, right, it is quite possible that you might participate in their sins. Now, why would he say that? Well, think about it. We're talking about the recognition and affirmation and appointment of leadership. So if someone being put in the place of leadership is not actually qualified, think about the downstream damage that could happen to the church, right? And we're in the context of confronting elders who are sinning, accusations that are verified and confronting them. And so Paul's saying to Timothy, walk carefully here, walk carefully, cautiously, because if you prematurely put somebody in a place of spiritual leadership and they're not qualified, either because they've got sins that will damage the church or they're not stable enough and will be led into the condemnation of the devil. Remember the new convert? He says, then you're going to bear responsibility for it. You will share in it because you're the person who helped lead this process and put them there. You let the wolf in with the sheep. And your job's supposed to be to guard and protect, not unleash. Right? So you'd participate in them. To set apart someone who's not qualified, either by commission or omission, that is, they're actively disqualified in the way they're living, or they haven't demonstrated their qualification, is to risk serious harm. One commentator said this way, it would be an act of shocking irresponsibility. I mean, I was trying to think of a way to maybe help us think about it, right? If you're a parent, you take seriously the care and protection of your children. So I hope generally, like, you have some kind of standards for your babysitters. You're going to entrust your children into the care of those people. And you would want to make certain that they're the kind of person that's going to protect them, not hurt them, that's going to influence them positively, not negatively. Right? And if you just said, man, I got to go somewhere. Hey, man, walking down the street. Come here. Can you watch my kids for overnight? I got to go somewhere. You'd say that's an act of shocking irresponsibility, right? That's exactly what Paul's saying here. Because really, if you turn around and handed that trust to somebody who was not worthy of it and they did something wrong, I know every person in this room would be, sure, that person needs to be tarred and feathered, but they'd be looking at you going, what is wrong with you? Why in the world would you put your kids in the care of that person? That's exactly the point here. Paul's saying to Timothy, if you let people who are not qualified step into this position, you become a participant in what they're doing because you have this responsibility. You have this responsibility. Do not act in this irresponsible kind of way. Because we have a tendency to sort of think as isolated individuals, we sometimes miss the biblical significance of this kind of sharing in things. Let me just show you. We're going to come right back here to 1 Timothy 5, but go to 2 John. 2 John. We're going to look at the second and third letters of John at a couple of texts to show this language of fellowship in ministry or participation in somebody's actions. The first one is going to be negative. 2 John, just so we can have context, start in verse 9. 2 John, so go to Revelation and come back. Jude, 3 John, 2 John, all right? Verse 9, anyone who goes too far and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. The one who abides in the teaching, he has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house. Do not give him a greeting. Notice why, verse 11, for the one who gives him a greeting participates in his evil deeds. Participates in his evil deeds. There's the language that we're talking about from 1 Timothy chapter 5. I think, and there's some debate about this, I think this context was written in a time of house churches, and so he's talking here, it could probably by extension be like someone shows up at your porch, don't invite him in your house. I think he's actually really focusing on the gathering of God's people, and remember you had itinerant people moving around, and so the believers gather together. And it might be and was more common for them to extend sort of like an official welcoming greeting. Think of Acts chapter 13 if you're familiar with it, right? Saul, Paul, and Barnabas are traveling and they go in the synagogue. And after the synagogue thing has happened, the leader of the synagogue looks over them and says, sirs, do you have anything to say? Right? They were recognized as people who might have something to contribute what's going on because Paul had been a teacher, right? And so they recognized them. They essentially welcomed them into the process. And that's, I think, what this text is talking about. And here's what this text is talking about. Someone comes in like that who doesn't hold to the teaching of Christ. You are not to receive them and greet them as if they're your brother in Christ, because if you do that, you actually become a participant in their evil. And that's different than the way we think, because we're like, well, no, man, that's their fault. That's not my fault. I'm not accountable for what they did wrong. Well, if you elevate and give them a platform, yeah, you are. That's what this text is saying. Same kind of thing going on in 1 Timothy 5. You lay hands on this person. That is, you mark them off to be a spiritual leader in the church. And if they're not actually someone who should be that, you have become a sharer in the damage that they do. All right, probably just across the page, 3 John, look at verses 7 and 8, because here's a positive side to it, right? Apparently not just across the page for some of you. All right, verse 7. Speaking about people who went out as missionaries, I believe, verse 7, for they went out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles. Therefore, we ought to support such men so that we may be fellow workers with the truth. And there's the idea of us being participants. We're joining in the work. We're co-laborers with them. In this case, it's via our financial support. Right? If someone's gone out for the sake of Christ's name to the Gentiles, they need support, so we ought to support them. And when we support them, we become co-laborers with them. We share in the work that they're doing, just like Paul says in Philippians chapter 4, that they, the Philippians, had become participants, fellowshipping with him in the work via their gifts. All right, so the reason I'm showing this is that our tendency is because we live in a culture that really emphasizes individualism, right? Everyone's all in a silo, all by themselves, right? I mean, if I put my hands on this person as a part of the ordaining, appointing process, and they go bad, that's on them. Not my problem. Maybe, maybe not. And you know what the difference between maybe and maybe not is? Did you do it too hastily? Did you do it too hastily? Right? If because the reality is a sad reality in a sinful world, you can have people who were faithful, were not new converts, who had been tested, and still at some point turn away. The guy who's writing this book of 1 Timothy had one of his co-laborers, Demas, at one point abandoned him, having loved the present world. Sin is non-discriminatory in its attacks, right? So it's possible that someone who has been properly vetted and trained and tested ends up harboring sin that causes them to be a damaging influence in the church. Right? I don't think the problem was that in that case, it wasn't that they were committed to the work too hastily, right? And so therefore, I don't think it would accrue to those who did. That'd be a problem downstream. But when someone is set aside too hastily, the problem's upstream, if I could put it that way. All right, go back, if you would, to 1 Timothy chapter 5. So there's the first reason. Right, you participate in the sins of other men. Look at the end of verse 22, because it says, keep yourself free from sin. And I take that actually to be a further statement connected to the reason why you don't do this, right? You share in the responsibility of sins for other people. So, Timothy, keep yourself free from sin. Don't do that. I don't think it's sort of like a general. So, Timothy, live a pure life in the middle of this context. I think he's saying specifically about don't do this. Keep yourself pure. Don't get entangled in the sins of other people. But what it does trigger for Paul is what we'd call like a parenthetical statement, a rabbit trail mentally, in which he addresses verse 23. And that's why most of the translations have it either in parenthesis or if you have a New American Standard Bible, you can see that the 23 is bold and then the 24 is bold. That means they're marking it off as a separate paragraph. So it's like an aside. And I think it's tied to the fact that there seems to have been a problem at Ephesus with drinking. Remember, one of the qualifications in chapter 3, verse 3, is that they cannot be addicted to wine. So part of the sins that are being confronted at Ephesus is probably that there are people who are spiritual leaders who actually are violating what the scriptures would warn us about drunkenness. And Paul, in the midst of urging Timothy to keep himself pure, is reminded of Timothy's physical situation, because look at the end of verse 23, your stomach and your frequent ailments, and of Timothy's practice, which is to exclusively drink water. All right, and so you have these things all coming together. Paul saying, Timothy, keep yourself from sin. Part of the sin at Ephesus is the drinking issue. Timothy seems to have taken a step to stay clear of that by only drinking water, but yet he's physically ill and actually needs to drink something that's healthier for him, right? And again, this is an issue you and I struggle with because you walk to a drinking fountain or a tap and drink water. Right, all over the globe, there's not drinkable water. The water actually brings disease and illness, so you have to have something done to help purify it. You introduce elements to purify it, right? And that's where they were. So Paul says to Timothy, listen, you need to change this practice. No longer, that's why I'm saying change it, no longer drink water exclusively, but use a little wine for the sake of your stomach and your frequent ailments. So And the whole topic of drinking probably is a lot much larger than this verse. But here's three things you need to understand about this verse, right? It addresses a unique cultural problem, one, by urging moderate use of wine, three, for medicinal purposes. All right, don't miss that, because he tells exactly why he should do this. For the sake of your stomach and your frequent ailments. It's not for social drinking. It's not for casual consumption of alcoholic beverages. It is for medicinal purposes. All right, so the reality of it is, those who are teetotalers, who call people to abstinence with regard to alcoholic beverages, I don't know any of them who have ever said you can't use alcohol in medicine. I mean, you realize NyQuil has a higher percentage of alcohol than a beer does? Don't go home and start drinking NyQuil, okay? Right? But the point is that lots of medicines have alcohol in them, and that's never been the point for believers precisely on a text like this. Right? And that's what this text is about. So you can have the debate over other texts. You can do whatever you want to do as you're working through this issue. But you cannot land on this verse and say, this verse says it's okay to drink socially. That is not what this text says. This text says, you're sick, take something for your health. That's what the text says. Right? And if you're going to be faithful to the text, you can only use the text the way the text says. So that's what this text says, right? And Paul's concerned for Timothy because Timothy seems to have taken a position beyond what he needed to, right? There's a problem with alcohol consumption among the leaders, so I'm going to remedy that by not drinking it at all. I'm only going to drink water. But the problem is it's aggravating Timothy's health condition, and Paul says to Timothy, Timothy, you need to stop that, and you need to take something that's better for your health. That's what he's talking about, and that's all he's talking about. All right, look at verse 24, because here comes a second reason why. If you rush ahead prematurely to appoint people for ministry, you not only participate in their sins or sins they commit, you prematurely elevate sinful men. Okay, and that may seem connected, but remember the first one's about Timothy. Timothy, you don't want to participate in those sins, but now he comes back to the issue of if you do this too quickly, you will elevate sinful men. All right, verses 24 and 25 actually are parallel to each other, and they're intended really to give us sort of flip sides of the same coin, one negative, one positive. Verse 24 is negative about sins, verse 25 positive about good deeds, and they follow the basic same pattern, right? Think about it this way. Sins, good deeds, quite evident, and then follow after and cannot be concealed. All right, so that's basically he's walking through. When you rush to judgment, Timothy, you are only going to catch those whose sins are evident. But some men's sins aren't evident. Some men's sins follow after. Right? And the language that he's talking about, if you think about it this way, is think about a herald in front of somebody, right? So I'm coming, and I've got somebody in front of me going, Dave Dorn is in the house, right? I mean, you know, just he's announcing me, right? What this text is painting, that kind of a picture, some men's sins are out in front of them, and they're evident, obvious, indisputable. You can see them coming a mile away. For that person, it's easy to go, they're not qualified. But some people's sins aren't out in front of them announcing themselves. They're actually trailing behind them. And it's going to take time for those to become evident. Right? That's what he's talking about. And so he's talking, remember, in the context of do not lay hands on anyone too hastily. Why, Paul? Because sometimes when you move too hastily, you haven't taken the time to evaluate well enough to know if there's a trail here of problems. You've only excluded the people who it was obvious, quite evident that they shouldn't be included. But there are people for whom it's not quite evident. It's going to take some time for that to surface. Okay, now, in the way that I just laid that out, I'm taking, therefore, in verse 24, the word judgment as the process of evaluation. Okay? And so let me just be honest, fair in the interpretation. Some people take it as referring to God's judgment. And so what they'd be saying is, some people, the sins they're committing, it's obvious. I mean, it's blaring the horn on its way to judgment. Other people, you're not going to know until the judgment day. Okay, so some people take it that way. I don't because of the context and what it's focusing on, right? I mean, the harsh way of saying it is it doesn't do Timothy a whole lot of good in deciding when to appoint somebody if Paul's basically saying someday in glory the truth will be revealed, right? The point is, I think, talking about the temporal process of identifying the character of people. Some it's obvious, some it takes some time. That's the point of it. Okay? Flip side of that's verse 25. Notice what it says here. Likewise also, deeds that are good are quite evident, and those which are otherwise cannot be concealed. And here the trick, the test is to what does otherwise apply? All right? Because here's, again, There's two ways in which you could take this. There are good deeds, and then there's another kind of deed. That's one way to take it. Or it is good deeds are evident, and sometimes they're not. Right? Because the otherwise could apply to either the good deeds or are quite evident. I think given the parallelism with verse 24 and the point of the context, that it's actually whether they're evident or not. All right, so here's what he's saying. Some people, I'll do the march in this way, all right? So I'm here. Hey, Dave Dorn's in the house, right? It's out front. Here's a good deed, and it's immediately obvious. My good deeds are immediately obvious, and so this is a guy who could be an elder. But there are some people that are not out there. There's some people that as they live their life of steady growth and maturity and humble service, their deeds are trailing behind them. And what Paul's saying is, those can't be concealed. At some point, they're going to bear fruit. They're going to be recognized. And here's the point. If you just jump toward affirmation of the people who are immediately evident, you're not only going to
elevate some prematurely sinful men, you're going to prematurely miss some good men. Right? Because if you're just looking at the present state and who's got obvious good deeds, you're going to go, let's go with them. And in fact, there's plenty of men growing in Christ, stably mature, competent with the word, have the character, that are just, they're just faithfully serving Christ. There maybe is no horn blown in front of them, but there's a trail behind them of faithful service and good deeds that are being demonstrated. And Paul's saying, so you need to take a look at those people too. Because if you rush to appointment, you haven't had time to see the trail over here or over there. You need to make certain that you're not operating in a hasty way, so that you can actually have a good assessment. And what's important, and I think it's important for us here, right, is because we believe in the autonomy of the local church, that is the self-governing nature of the local church, this appointment doesn't happen from outside, right? So what happened in March of 1986 is really not the significant issue with regard to my life. What happened in January of 1989 is, right? This church, and technically, this unplanned, but 29 years ago today, the church installed me as the senior pastor, right? And that's the issue that matters, because the autonomy of the local church is each church is self-governing, and because we believe in congregational government, it means the body of believers has a very important and sacred sort of stake in this issue. So if we're, as a church, going to obey this text, it actually is we're going to obey it. Not just I'm going to obey it, or those of us that come up on the platform as pastors are going to obey it, but we're all going to say, we will not rush through this process because we don't want to participate in the sins of those who are not qualified. We don't want to rush because we don't want to make a premature judgment on people who are sinfully not qualified, nor do we want to make a premature judgment on those who actually may be qualified that we overlook. Right? We need to walk steadily. And the office, really, the office is for those who are fit, if I could put it this way, not those who are flashy. Right? It's not to be done like a student body election or some kind of talent contest. God's standards are different than the world's. I mean, think Jesus. Think of Jesus. Isaiah says there was nothing in his appearance that would have caused us to look to him. He was not the one that's going to get the most likely to succeed vote. But what was he? He was fully committed to his Father's will, only spoke what the Father told him to speak, did what the Father said to do, showed a demonstration of courage and commitment to the task in spite of what was happening around him. When was reviled, he did not revile again. Right? He was, and is the chief shepherd. And those who are under shepherds should aspire to be like him, to have his character, to live in the confidence of what Jesus has done, so that they're not living for the flash, not living for the approval of people, because they have the approval of God through Christ. They've been accepted by God on the basis of the righteousness of Christ. And so they can serve in the confidence that the gospel gives them. Let's bow together, please, in prayer. Father, please help us to think biblically about leadership and congregations and our responsibility as a church body. Help us to be faithful to your word here and do what you've told us without bias or partiality, honoring those who are worthy of honor, confronting those who are disobeying your will, walking carefully through the process of selection and affirmation so that your house is ordered according to your will and your people are built up and strengthened and the mission of Christ is fulfilled. We thank you for that great privilege. In Jesus' name, amen.